Fear the Fro.
Shot clock by Mobley. Holy Mobley.
Donovan Mitchell is 8 for 8 from downtown.
Darius Garland hit it from Euclid. Lobdell is pow. Oh, that was gorgeous.
A Cleveland Cavalier podcast.
What do we need to add? What do we need to give coach?
The game has come down to space and opportunity.
We address that.
Hosted by the voice of Fox Sports Radio.
Yeah, his name is Bob Schmidt.
Bob Schmidt.
Spectacular talent.
That guy is a legend.
Got it, the buzzer!
Welcome to the Fear the Fro podcast game day. Game one, quick turnaround. I realize it seems like we were just reveling in game seven, but I wanted to speak to a group of men. Really, it's fronted by this one man that I'm speaking to today, but it's bigger than any one person. It's a movement that's existed in the Cavalier community for years and years, and that is a website called RealCavsFans.com. Now, when I was just a young boy, a supple young boy, rooting for the Cavaliers, I would go there as a man who, I grew up in Buffalo, most of you realize that by now, there weren't a lot of people talking about the Cavs. And just like the impetus to start this podcast was to find my own community of fans, fellow like-minded Cavalier fans, for a time, pre-podcast, you know, pre-Reddit, realcavsfans.com was where I would go to discuss Cleveland Cavalier basketball, or at least read other people discussing Cleveland Cavalier basketball. And today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Smooth, one of the contributors to that site, the man behind film breakdowns and game write-ups and recaps, and he agreed to join me to discuss, well, all things Cavaliers, but this playoff run specifically, things we've learned about the team, the direction of the team. We're all over the place here, so I will get to it now. I'm just going to get into the conversation, which I taped yesterday with my guy Smooth. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, appreciate having us. Excited to get down to business.
Yeah, for sure. We took care of business in game seven, fortunately, or this could have been a very different conversation. We've been talking about doing a pod for a bit, but I kind of wanted to sit on it in hopes that we would arrive here. How did you come away feeling after the first round series with Orlando?
Exhausted, thankful, relieved. Whatever any of those words I'm thinking, I'm sure JB Bickerstaff, maybe not so much, but him and Kobe Altman are feeling as well. It's hard. I don't think people realize how hard it is to win in the playoffs. I think HBO Sports had a good realization of that, where Timberwolves went 20 years between winning after KG left, 8 years after Durant left for OKC. It's only 6 years for the Cavs. So while the rebuild has felt like it's taken forever, rebuilding is hard, especially in a smaller market. The Knicks, after Melo left, I think it took them 6 years until they finally reached the second round. So I don't think people realize how hard it is to win, and especially win in the playoffs. So anything that they've experienced is normal. It's not that the Cleveland gods are looking down upon Cleveland and spiting them. Well, maybe some, but you know, it's hard to win in today's day and age, especially as a smaller market. So to actually see them break through is the kind of type of growth that people have been asking for and wanting to see. It may not have been smooth all the way along. It's been bumpy, but they're able to do what a lot of people have wanted them to do.
One of the things that never does the Cavs discourse any favors is you get situations like game three or game four or even game six, like all the road games, essentially. To have them either be lost in blowout fashion, and you saw the stat, I'm sure you have shared it as well, as far as point differential and where the Cavs rank. They managed to win the series with the fourth worst point differential by a playoff series winner. And I think it exacerbates the problem sometimes, but I do think it's important what you pointed out. It has been a much faster rebuild than most people could anticipate, but I think where maybe some of the impatience fed into it was when the Cavaliers kind of made an all-in move and bringing in Donovan Mitchell. That primed people to think, we expect very rapid returns here. And in reality, it rarely plays out that way, short of having a generational superstar. What are some of the things that you would point to as positives in our progress towards ultimately becoming a contender? Things that you're satisfied with?
I think starting on the positive, more satisfied, that's why you acquired Donovan Mitchell. The superstar or star is the ultimate trump card. And in the end, that's what got them to the next level. All due respect to Colin Sexton and Lauri Markkanen, RIP, but they're not getting you past what Donovan Mitchell just did. Of the losses, Mitchell was only the lead scorer once. All four of the wins, Mitchell was leading scorer. It's not an advanced stat, but I think that tells you how important it is to have that trump card in Mitchell. So that's ultimately why you make that move. Why you push all the cards forward is to acquire a talent like that, especially in a small market. How often does a team like Cleveland have the opportunity to acquire a superstar talent in there or before their prime on a long-term contract? So I think from the optimistic standpoint, I think it's kind of vindicating for this is why we push the chips in to acquire a talent like Mitchell. On the other end, when you acquire Mitchell, your young talent's timeline is now Mitchell's timeline. There's no more let's wait and develop and see where this goes. With Mitchell and the type of talent that he brings, it's kind of hearkening back to LeBron, where LeBron's timeline is the franchise's timeline. And that didn't always mesh, as we saw and are seeing even LA now. And so with Mitchell, Mobley and Garland specifically, they didn't have a choice but to be ready. There were ups and downs in the series with regards to that. How those two develop, jury's still out. You know, I think there's a lot more maybe to build off of from when it comes to Mobley, Garland, the inconsistencies throughout the series. This last game, not really doing much throughout the game, but then game goes to the fourth quarter, and that's when he really performs. You know, he's really accounting for most of your points in that fourth quarter. He was your leading scorer in that fourth quarter. So there's glimpses, but not the consistent approach that you're wanting to see to match kind of where Mitchell is at. So that's probably disappointing, number one. But number two, it gets down to the offense. In this series, I think it exposed the lack of kind of offensive backbone when it comes to the team. Really what it got down to was, can your isolation players bail you out when it came down to it? Or could your shooters live up to what you had hoped they would be? And that was inconsistent. So kind of when the shooting went by the wayside, it really put a lot more pressure on Garland and Mitchell. With Mitchell's knee, with Garland's inconsistency, that kind of really broke things down even further. The thing that kind of gets to me is that, you know, Bickerstaff has some good sets. They do run some good action to get some good looks, some plays off a pin down, some handoffs. So it's not like there's not good looks within the system. It just overall, what can you point to that they really can build off of and fall back on when things get difficult? We've seen it in the clutch situations. It devolves into kind of that pick and roll isolation, my turn, your turn, which can work. You know, with Kyrie and LeBron and even Kyrie and Luka now, you know, when you have truly elite isolation players, your offense is going to be better than anything that the defense can throw at you. But when it comes to Mitchell and Garland, you're still going to need something to fall back on. So I think those are two things, kind of the offense, how that looked, but also the development of the young pieces. I'm hoping that's something you can build off of here going to the next series.
Yeah, I certainly came away feeling pretty optimistic about Evan, just from the standpoint of take what you will from the scoring. I'm not saying you have to feel great about where he's at offensively, but to see an extended stretch where we didn't have Jared Allen, because I don't think that was a definitive, concrete, you know, we know that Evan can hold up as a, you know, full-time five when needed to situation, at least not in high leverage games like the playoffs. So for him to come in those three games defensively, it was a completely dominant series from Evan start to finish. And it only got better as time went along. 10 of his 21 blocks in the last two games. Regardless of what your personal feelings may be about what the direction of the future of the team should be, this isn't an anomaly team of, okay, well, this is one of the few teams Evan should be able to sustain in a full-time five-position role. This was a big squad. And Evan, I think, passed with rave reviews.
Last game, game seven, Mobley out-rebounded Mo Wagner, Jonathan Isaac, and Wendell Carter himself. People were concerned, like you mentioned, can he live up to the, you know, being a center full-time? Can he do it, especially against a more physical opponent? And I think those type of performances kind of speak to that. Throw in a handful of blocks and you're off to the races. I think this series really spoke to his overall versatility, which we maybe take for granted defensively. Starting the series, he's guarding Banchero, their best perimeter player, and had a lot of success against him. Ending the series, he's your full-time center, having to bang down low more often, really causing havoc from a pick-and-roll perspective, help coverage. So it really speaks to his overall versatility, which I think people take for granted when it comes to how skilled defensively he is, and really focused a lot on the offense about maybe what he can't do or what he's not doing yet, but take for granted what he can is already delivering defensively and really enables them to do a lot with their two guards on that end of the floor. You know, offensively, it's it's going to come, but we're also talking about a year where Caris LeVert had more shot attempts than Evan Mobley in the regular season. When you bring in Mitchell, you're building around Mitchell. How Mobley's development is maybe not as much of a priority as it was before. So I think that's sometimes where the disconnect comes in, where, you know, Cavs have been preaching he's a unicorn, he's this, he's that, when in reality, the resources that they maybe would be providing to him really haven't been there just because of how the team is and where the team wants to go. How they utilize him offensively will kind of be the talk of the offseason, but I think carrying around the hand exercise, hand clamps, is probably going to be number one priority, just like you saw the football players in high school carrying those footballs in every classroom. I think he's having to carry those hand clamps, ensure that loose balls, turnovers that he's carrying in traffic are converted to foul, to free throws and finishes. But there's glimpses. I think there's a lot to build off of. And kind of as you think about the core moving forward, it's how to really accentuate what he does well.
Well, now, are you of the expectation that Evan is going to be manning the middle on his own to begin this series? Because I talked about it a little bit on the podcast yesterday. I mean, if you're to believe what everybody was saying prior to the game about trouble breathing, can't lift his arm over his head, I'm talking about Jared Allen, of course, how would you feel about Evan's chances going into a series where he's still the anchor big against this Celtics squad?
I'd feel a little bit better, to be honest, than facing the Magic. I mean, I think the Magic and the Celtics, so I think one of the good things is that they presented a similar look where their offense really built around their two kind of wing forward creation guys. So Banchero, Wagner, Tatum, Brown, that's the core of their offense. That's how they dictate their offense and how they run it. The way they differ is the Magic are really going to beat you up inside, really get to the free throw line. But the Celtics, it's the complete opposite. Their three-point shooting is near the top of the league. So they're really more so working through them to create kickout looks, other opportunities to work off of that. I think from that aspect, taking a step back, you know, when you talk about physicality and how Mobley reacts to that, really I think it plays more into his ability to defend out on the perimeter, be more versatile, be more agile. So I think that's going to take some off of his plate. I think the interesting thing is I'd almost say Dean Wade's more important to the second round than Jared Allen. That's not taking anything away from Jared Allen, because arguably he was probably their second best player in the Magic series, with credit to him after the Knicks series. But when you talk about kind of how the Celtics are built, it's those two wing players, and the Magic series really exposed one of the biggest issues the Cavs have had throughout the last 2 years. It's, can they defend size? Okoro, Strew stepped up. I mean, even Mobley, when we talked about his chances on Banchero, that's kind of where it stops. I mean, that's why you're bringing the corpse of Marcus Morris Jr. off to guard some of these guys, why you're sticking Niang in some of those situations, because that's where they're at currently. So because of Porzingis being out, I think Mobley can easily handle that, but it then shifts even more focus to, can you handle those wings? Shifting Mobley to center takes him off one of those wings for most of the time. And if Wade's out, that only exacerbates that. So from that aspect, from coverage wise, you know, I'd have more concern about Wade's health and availability than Allen. And that's not taking anything away from Allen, just talking about matchups, you know, how we see things progressing in the second round.
I understand where you're coming from with Dean. And what I would say with this, my concern would be that asking Evan to have to guard a lot more on the perimeter exposes him to probably a lot more fouls, because there's few people as adept at contesting without fouling as Evan Mobley. I think you're more likely to draw him into those situations in motion than you are when you give him an opportunity to just load up in front of the rim. Those battles he wins time and time again. So I do have my concerns in that regard, because foul trouble is the one singular thing we can't afford with Evan Mobley. So while getting Dean would give us another body to throw at tall wings, which we need, I also think the ability to switch on those, you know, screens and those actions between Jarrett and Evan pretty interchangeably is a massively valuable thing. One component that I think is going to make it much more difficult for Evan is the outside shooting prowess of a Boston, because it's going to make it tougher to condense the floor and to shade in and try to help Evan in some of those situations. He may find himself on an island a lot more frequently. That's why I think these wings are so critical, how Max performs, how Isaac performs. They're tasked with a big role, at least initially, to start this series. Those are the guys for me that we know are available that could swing this series for the Cavs. Who is the guy on the other side of the ball for you, for the Celtics, who you see in that light, an X factor?
I think without Porzingis, that scoring responsibility is really going to shift back to Derek White and Jrue Holiday. So I think with Porzingis, they have a clear-cut number three, you know, offensively, kind of how they tier things. I think that allows White and Holiday to kind of be more opportunistic, focus on spot-ups, you know, focus on drives, kickouts, creation off that. They're going to be having to play both ends, and they've done it really well. So it's not saying that they can't do that. I mean, they're two of the better two-way guards in the league. I mean, credit to Derek White. He almost made an all-star game. I think it's going to be interesting how they handle that additional offensive responsibility when it comes to Porzingis being out and kind of that totem pole being bumped up. So we saw it with the Cavs, you know, when guys were asked to step outside of their totem pole responsibility-wise, they didn't do as well. So how they kind of adjust to that will be interesting to watch when it comes to their offensive prowess.
Yeah, it certainly feels like, at least in the immediate aftermath, Derek White is coming off a couple of big performances. And the fact that, you know, he outscored Tatum in that first-round series is wild when you look at the splits that he was able to put out there. Now, Jaylen and Tatum, they didn't necessarily have the best outside shooting performance, but Derek White was flirting with a 60-50-90 over the course of the series. Not to say nothing of the fact that the guy just doesn't turn the ball over either. So as much as during the regular season, I was kind of disgusted of, you know, Celtics media forcing this narrative of his greatness down our throat, I would kill to have one of the Cavaliers' secondary stars perform like he has so far. I'm curious to get a tone of your feeling of the best direction for this team based on the evidence we have now. Obviously, this could change if something happens in this series, but if this season had ended, how would you feel going into this summer? What would be the things that you would do if you were tasked as, you know, the general manager, if you were in Altman's shoes?
Would I still have a job?
Well, you know, good question. Let's start there. It feels like, to me anyway, that it's more or less universally just accepted that nobody expects JB back, barring a miracle run or Donovan's direct intervention on his behalf. Altman is, it's a lot harder to gauge. Me personally, some of the things you said earlier in this conversation resonate with me. And I'll make my case for Altman here. I think there's two ways to view what's happened here since we made the Donovan Mitchell trade. Let's start with the negative interpretation. We made an all-in trade before we were ready. We blew our draft assets, and Donovan Mitchell was never the level of star acquisition that was going to put us over the top. And we would have been better off holding on to Lauri Markkanen and Colin Sexton and our draft assets for a future better maneuver. Now, maybe you believe some of those, maybe you believe all of those, but let me give you a more positive presentation. Maybe you consider it a more delusional presentation of the same set of facts, but viewed through a different lens. Consider how many small market GMs could even pull that maneuver off, getting a top 15 talent in his prime, not beyond the age of 30, with 3 full years of control left, to a small market. Usually, if you bring a superstar to a small market, it's before their ascent. It's a Shea Gilgeous thing. Or it's when a descent is on the horizon. It's a Dame Lillard situation. He wasn't tradable until he was tradable because he was on the biggest contract possible and on the backside of his career. The only superstars typically get moved in their mid-20s are about to hit unrestricted free agency. They're your Paul Georges or your Anthony Davises or your Carmelo Anthonys. This was a unique situation. I would argue it is the most low-risk version of an all-in trade that you could probably put together. And because we're mid-playoff run and I'm on a bit of a monologue here, I'm not even going to dive into the turning a Marjon Beauchamp first-round pick into an all-star center in Jared Allen or identifying a cast-off from another team, turning Larry Nance Jr. into Lauri Markkanen and then using that as a young cost-controlled piece, which helped you land Donovan in the first place. But my point is essentially, I think Kobe Altman has done enough to prove that he deserves a chance to reshape this roster if it comes to that point, and not to be deposited in the dumpster alongside of a head coach. So I'm curious what your views are on this move.
I think Katzner and I Lies would be jealous of J.B. Bickerstaff and his ability to survive throughout all the endeavors that he's had over the course of these many years. Like you said, I think bearing an upset, an historic upset, which Cleveland knows how to make history, it's hard to see a pathway for him getting back. I think there's been a longstanding thought that JB was this franchise's Mark Jackson and they need their Steve Kerr, where you had a guy to kind of build the culture, build up some of the talent, sift through some of the rubble that you had from the aftermath. But ultimately, is he that guy to get to the next step? Don't know. You know, one of our members had pointed out just how long it took some of the elite coaches to make it to the second round. We have a guy like Jerry Sloan, you know, some of those elite coaches, it can take a while. So are the Cavs willing to stomach JB's development? Probably not. Again, because you're on the Mitchell timeline. If you're on the Garland Mobley timeline without Mitchell, maybe, but on the Mitchell timeline, pending his decision in the summer, because ultimately that's your North Star, your guiding light. What he does dictates the rest of the franchise. I know Winhurst was on ESPN Cleveland earlier, and he said, you know, he's not sure if Mitchell's going to have a voice or demand a voice, but if ultimately he has one, that's probably where things are headed. So I think offense development is kind of the key in the offseason. Can JB reach that? Luke Walton was supposed to be brought in to help that. So moving forward, regardless of Mitchell, you're probably going to want to see what else this core can do under different guidance to ensure that you know what you have. That's why kind of caution, depending on what camp you're in with JB Bickerstaff, are you letting that influence your decision on Evan Mobley, Darius Garland, and Jared Allen in the core? If you don't believe in him, do you believe in his guidance of the team and what you see, and are you willing to make decisions off of that? When it comes to Altman, he's brought in talent. Like you mentioned, Jared Allen, Donovan Mitchell, a lot of the development they've had, Sam Merrill, Dean Wade, Lamar Stevens, a lot of those guys, that's not easy to do. And finding cost-controlled assets who can produce is a critical step for teams that are getting higher in salary cap situations, especially when you have Mobley's contract coming up, Mitchell's contract coming up, potential Allen down the road. So those are critical components to building out a team. You know, identifying some talent. I know Strus has been up and down, but relatively a productive, positive player. He's done well to identify talent, but how that talent fits is the question. You know, one of the things that we've kind of talked about is the disconnect between being so aggressive and making a move for Mitchell, but then being sort of passive in how you follow that up. So they've been dormant at the deadlines the last few years. They've kind of allowed the productive play leading up to the deadline to influence their decision-making a little bit where, you know, we're doing well, let's not rock the boat. And then second half comes and it's, maybe we should have rocked the boat. You know, you have LeVert who is re-signing with the intent of accommodating that asset to ensure you can extend it into something else. And now who knows how that's valued in the summer being he's expiring coming off a up and down season. So, you know, it's kind of this connect of you've been so aggressive in trying to acquire Mitchell, but kind of how you follow it up, some of that aggressive nature and trying to take advantage of the window you have now really hasn't been there. So, you know, if he's unwavering in his support to Bickerstaff, I'm not sure how you can justify continuing that. But I think if he's open to exploring what other potential fits are to guiding this franchise, that's when you really get down to, do you believe in him? And last thing I'll say is, if you're questioning whether or not you believe in a coach or a GM, do you really have one?
I think that's fair. What I would say with Donovan is, if he's unwilling to sign an extension early, if he doesn't sign an extension this summer, I can't see him inserting himself into any type of, you know, front office head coaching decisions. The only thing that may possibly be able to save JV would be a huge change of direction in terms of our offensive performance. We've actually regressed from last season. We have a lower offensive rating than last year's playoffs, which I realize different opponents, you can't really parallel, but still, it speaks to how much we're leaving on the table. And things aren't going to get easier. Boston is an elite three-point shooting team. We're not a good three-point shooting team, which brings me to the next guy I wanted to address with you. That is Sam Merrill, of course. Sammy Snipes. Do you see a scenario where JB gives him guaranteed minutes in this round, an actual role, now that we're playing a slightly smaller team than we were last round?
How does he not? I think that's the question. I think people will be surprised during the regular season. So Boston obviously was first in three-point shooting, almost 42.5 attempts per game. Cavs were eighth in three-point attempts per game throughout the entire course of the season. Post All-Star break, they kind of dropped to 11th. But also post All-Star, they were seventh in three-point percentage. So I'm not sure if that's what people would have expected going into the playoffs. Their three-point attempts dropped by about 7 per game. They were at 29.9 in the playoffs. That was 14th. Their 28.7% is second last. So reason to bring that up is, one, if they're going to want to have a chance, they're going to have to shoot well. There's no doubt about it. You're not going to get by making 8, 10 three-points per three-pointers per game against the Magic like you are the Celtics. That's not going to happen. If there's room for optimism, it's maybe they go closer to the mean of what they were during the regular season. So it's not like they're incapable of doing that. They showed that they can be a halfway decent 3-point percentage team. May not be the Celtics, but they've shown that they can do enough. That's why, you know, if you're struggling to find shooting, you have to play Merrill. Okoro Niang, LeVert Morris, 13 made 3-pointers in 7 games. That's just not sustainable. Perhaps it slides in the Magic series. It's not going to slide in the Celtics series. So if you're really struggling to find shooting to that extent, Merrill has to be a part of that conversation. You know, they're really searching for offense. Depending on what Caris LeVert shows up, those are those situations where inserting Merrill can really help kind of stabilize those units to maybe it's not a 8-point swing, maybe it's a 2-point swing, and you're better able to manage those situations and getting through to the next quarter, getting your starters back in the game. So, you know, I think there's going to be some hope with Strus. He was 3-14 to start the series and then 9-24 the last 3 games. So that's a positive. I don't know if many people would guess Garland was the best 3-point percentage shooter on the team. He's at 40%, 14 3-pointers made. He was only attempting 5 a game. That can't happen. You have to shoot more than that, especially if you're going to be as effective as he was. And I think that's been the gripe throughout the year is he has to be aggressive and stay aggressive. That fluctuation in effort, fluctuation and kind of him looking for a shot, you know, he kind of talked about it himself. A lot of the post-game endeavors is, you know, guys have been on me, my family's been on me, teammates have been on me. I have to stay aggressive, and it's true. So I'm glad he recognizes that, but please stay aggressive. Take those shots. If they're going under, launch that thing. You know, more off-ball action. If Mitchell's going to be on the ball as much as he is, try to find your spacing off-ball wise. So, you know, there's some things they can look forward to. It's how does JB ultimately employ that? And when it comes to how healthy do they get, what does that look like moving forward?
Yeah, I am full endorsement. We'll overlook any missed shots from Darius at this point. On those percentages, I just want the volume up. I don't want a guy to have to be cajoled into having confidence. I don't think, as much as heartwarming as it is to watch Donovan Mitchell put his arm around him and read about patronizing chest taps or whatever it is, shouldn't be necessary. You are Darius Garland. You are already on your max deal. You don't need to show an ounce of restraint. Carte blanche. So now time to make some predictions. Smooth. Hit me. Where are you at?
Cleveland fans are realistic but delusional. So I would say that. I think we know where this series is likely headed. But I think in our deep down wine and gold colored glasses, we always think or hope there's a chance. I know we've kind of parroted this stat, but you know the Cavs, Nuggets, and Magic are the only teams the last 2 years that have a winning record against the Celtics. It means something. You know, they're 1-2 this year. 2 of those losses came without Mobley. The 1 win came without Mitchell. I think if there's an opportunity, game 1 is kind of what I have circled. Given the Cavs are kind of coming off a uplifting series ending, can they kind of carry that momentum where the Celtics have been off for 5-6 days? You know, the same prep time is there. It's not like the Celtics had an advantage in prepping for the Cavs, no more than the Cavs had for prepping for the Celtics. So, you know, can the Cavs kind of ride that rhythm and kind of catch the Celtics off guard game 1 and really flip the series? That's kind of what I'm watching for, especially without Porzingis. You know, how do they adjust to that? So ultimately, I think the Celtics are just too good. The Cavs really haven't been able to play consistent basketball for most of the year. Even in the Celtics and the Magic series, we saw just really the peaks and valleys. They can maybe overcome that against the Magic. That's not a disrespect to them, but the level of the Magic and level of the Celtics are two different entities we're talking about. So I think ultimately there's the overall inconsistency. They won't be able to overcome that. But, you know, I do think it is going to be a competitive 5-6 games when it comes down to it.
Yeah, I think I'm landing on 5, in part because of how we performed on the road in the first round and knowing that we're heading to Boston against a team that was absolutely unbelievable at home this season. They were 37-4. So to expect wins there without Jared Allen, without Dean Wade, I think it's asking a lot. Of course, hope to be proved wrong, but if we can't shrink that disparity in 3-point makes between the two teams, I think some of these games could get away from us fairly rapidly. I would come away from this series feeling like it's a victory if we can just play them competitively throughout. It's not necessarily even about the number of games we take them to. It's about how we perform in whatever amount of games we have. I would take a most competitive sweep in NBA history Lakers type situation if that's what it comes to and feel like, okay, at least this is a step forward. It's not ultimately where we want to be. but I hope we're in all of these games. I don't want these games like we had in the Orlando series where home and road, it seems vastly different. And the road, it's been a test so far. It's not going to get any easier in this round.
Well, and I would say too, you know, I think the Magic and the Knicks kind of pose some similar problems for the Cavs or kind of some similar things to overcome. In the last two playoff series, they were 3-0 when they scored 100-plus points. It's been a struggle to get there, and that struggle is going to be a different struggle against the Celtics where you're not going to have a choice other than score 100-plus points if you want any chance against them. So from that aspect, because of how much of a struggle their offense has been, this is really going to be a different challenge for the Magic and Knicks. You maybe can skirt by playing them, but the Celtics are a different level offensively. Both the Knicks and the Magic series, those were very pressure-filled situations. There was expectations and hopes within the first round. Now advancing to the second round, there's really not any expectations. I don't mean to say that from a player's perspective. You know, I'm sure the players expect to win and want to win, but I think from an overall perspective of everyone said, you must win the Magic series or else. Celtics, I think they're the underdog, so I do wonder how that pressure and expectation may change how they play as opposed to missing a shot, missing an opportunity. That's something we should have done as opposed to Celtics. Well, if we miss it, we are expected to miss it. So we'll see if that changes anything. Probably not, but maybe something to watch the game within the game.
I'm willing to hope that that's the case too. And it's funny because I was thinking about that with the Magic kind of in reverse. You know, when we advanced in the first round, the general discourse was, well, who cares? Orlando took you to 7. And it made me wonder, how are Magic fans receiving this? Just having people be like, oh, well, the team that beat you, they're irrelevant because they beat you, Orlando. Like, it's not only discredits us, but it discredits them. And I just hope that when we come out of this playoff series, that we're not in that situation we were in last year where people are just piling on in the way that they did after the Knicks series. Because that will mean that we showed up and gave a fight and had some positive things happen and hopefully some step forward. So I'm looking forward to this series. I'm glad that you took the time because I know I can't remember if I've said this earlier in this conversation or before we started taping, but RealCavsFans.com has been a site that for the entirety, basically, of my recall of internet era Cav fandom has existed in some form or another. You know, before Reddit, before all those places, when I was just a Cavs fan on an island in the middle of a bunch of people who weren't Cavs fans, and I was looking for anybody covering the team or talking about the team, they've been there. So I would tell anybody who's listening to this podcast that doesn't to make sure you follow at Real Cavs Fans and check out the forums and check out, you know, their podcast and check out all the stuff that those guys are doing because it's really incredible. And I think it's a big addition to the Cavs community.
No, definitely appreciate the kind words and all are welcome. You know, if you think you and your friends and your text threads are getting out of hand, just come and check out our game threads. So if you want to express your frustration and live the ups and downs just as much as anyone else, welcome to join us. And even throughout, you know, there's a discussion for you there and always welcome to contributing. But appreciate the kind words. Appreciate having us on. Hope to do this again sometime soon. Hopefully
after a victory. Hopefully on the way to the Eastern Conference Finals. No, I feel the same way, Smooth. I'm super excited for whatever's to come, good, bad, or otherwise. Just to be living to see some more high-pressure, high-leverage basketball, I think is very meaningful on this path that we're on to try to get to that echelon of team. So thank you for taking the time today. This has been the Fear the Fro podcast, guys. Game one tonight. Rate, review, subscribe, do all those things. And join me next time. Now, out of just pure superstition, I'm going to close the podcast with the Dean Wade song. Come back soon, Dean.
Dean Wade, he's not an impressive physically specimen guy.
How dare you?
Hey! Knocks it down.
You got the drip. Dean Wade's the drippiest Dean. He's the drippiest damn small forward you've ever seen. He got that drip. And he's a scoring machine. The 3 and D undrafted free agent development dream. His name is Drip. Drip.